have white skin, got assassin eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. A well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in a noose. Any minute now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. People are crazy and time is strange. Locked inside, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts for the dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and time's strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain used to care, but things have changed. Walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Some days are too hard to touch. The human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first woman I meet. Putting her in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Just don't show it. You could hurt someone not even knowing. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. I'm in love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager to make them stay. Some people are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today's date is the 16th of April, 2018. It's a Monday. And you're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio a couple minutes after 8 a.m. Arizona time. We'll get back to our study on insurgency, guerrilla war, and talk about the inception and the evolution of an insurgency, and then the transition to civil war, alternative solutions, and throw out the Cuban example. Also have some border news. Thanks for taking the time to tune into Liberty Tree Radio, and thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. You can get that at the website and the contact information. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. First two words phonetically, Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. Send this one out to Lily Grace Antoinette. Bob Miner, still in the jam. His telephone number, if you'd like to leave a brief message, 701-251-2365. 701-251-2365. It'll ask if you'd like to speak to him directly or if you'd like to purchase a phone card. And then it'll ask you to key in the first three letters of his last name. And his last name is spelled M-I-N-E-R, so that would translate out to 646. And then you'll have about 7 to 10 seconds to leave a brief message, some words of encouragement. If you'd like to send him a letter, the first line is S-C-C-C, so that would be Sierra Charlie Charlie Charlie, 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. SCCC 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. Let's see, I guess the Gunnery Sergeant Hartman and the movie Full Metal Jacket passed away this weekend. So he's like 74 years old, complications of pneumonia. And also, don't recall the name, but it was one of the founders of the radio station or the broadcast Coast to Coast. And it wasn't the new guy, George Norrie, but it was the guy that was on previous to that. I guess he also passed away this weekend in Nevada. Have some interesting, think about it, items. I'm sure that a lot of people have been hearing about this Syria bombing, missile attack deal, retaliation. And you know, I've heard some radio broadcast this weekend on people's thought process on that. The over in North Korea, you have Kim Jong-un. He wants to threaten countries and fire missiles. And now we have President Trump threatening other countries and firing missiles. So a little confused on why one is good and one is bad. And yes, we can bicker, well, these are ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and rockets and yeah. Threatening another country and that. Also with President Trump, one of the campaign promises against abortion and taxpayer money going to fund Planned Parenthood, and now he turns around and signs a spending bill to send money to Planned Parenthood. And you know, they always love to hide behind the children. Oh, the women and children that were killed in this attack, and oh, it's just so horrible. And I'm sure if people are familiar with the United States involvement in Iran all the way back in the 1953 with Mossadegh, and then the Ayatollahs, and they take over the embassy, et cetera, and then there was the USS Vincent's in the Persian Gulf, and I think that was during the Reagan administration back in about 1981 or thereabouts. And you recall that we had encouraged Saddam Hussein of Iraq to attack into Iran. I guess they felt that because the country was kind of in disarray with the transition of the government, that Saddam could go on in there and take over about 100 miles on the east side of the Tigris River, where a lot of the rich oil fields of the Iranians are, and that turned into a big mess with back and forth and human wave assaults and chemical weapons and drug on for 8 years. Pretty soon the border stabilized back about to the same place after how many ever people died. But during that, and we had supplied the Shah of Iran with a lot of F-14s, and on the 3rd of July, I don't recall exactly what year, it was in the 1980s, there was a airplane flight, commercial airline in international airspace called Iran Air Flight 655 that had taken off from Tehran, Iran, and it was flying across the Persian Gulf. And it was going to land on the Arabian Peninsula. Now, they were 30 minutes late getting off the ground. And it was Airbus A300, A320, a great big aircraft that had 290-some people on board. And this captain of the USS Vincent's, they interpreted it, and at the time, the USS Vincennes cost $1 billion, and it was the most advanced surface ship that the United States Navy had ever fielded. And somehow they misinterpreted the radar return from their phased array radar, and they claimed that they thought that it was an F-14 diving at the plane, so they fired two standard missiles, and first one sheared off the right engine, and the second one sheared off the tail, and the plane plummeted into the Persian Gulf, killing all. I'm sure there were women and children on board. And the Reagan administration first came out and denied it for about a week. Oh, there was a lot of morgues all around Iran. They just went and collected dead bodies and went and spread them into the Persian Gulf. We've never heard anybody over there. And then about a week later, they knew that the gig was up, and they actually came out and admitted it. Now, the United States government, the taxpayers of the United States paid $100,000 per person that perished, but we somehow refused to pay for the airplane itself. Just as a little sideline, I know that supposedly Muammar Gaddafi and the Libyans had something to do with the downing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, and that's questionable. But Gaddafi and Libya paid $1 million per person on that flight. So I don't know the difference about what the value of an Iranian versus an American is, but $100,000, $1 million. Oh, why is it that we hear all about one and hardly nothing about that? And there's other examples of the hypocrisy in these firing of missiles and shooting down of planes, and we're over there for the good one, and it's in the national interest and things. And I kind of scratch my head and wonder what's cooking, because if President Assad spends his time protecting the Alawites and the Christians against attacks by ISIS, and then he turns around and gasses the very same people, supposedly gasses the very same people that he's been protecting, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it's just now I hear after the retaliation with the cruise missiles, I heard it was a couple of B-1s out of Qatar that had fired these missiles. Now, I don't know if, like the last time, if only half of them actually hit the target. I'm not sure if we'll ever know the truth about that. But I just find that all of a sudden that we're getting ready to leave, and it just seems to be by coincidence that all of a sudden Bashar al-Assad is going to decide to stage a chemical attack and attack the people that he's been protecting. So you just kind of wonder, and now all of a sudden after the attack, now we're going to have investigators going over there and looking into it, kind of like the cart before the horse. Don't you think that maybe they should have sent the investigators in there before any decision was made? And of course, there's another one of these issues of about chemical attacks, and that occurred in a church in Waco, Texas, many years ago, that 93 people lost their lives, women and children. And I noticed that Russia or China didn't bomb the FBI headquarters or the ATF's headquarters in retaliation. Obviously, we know some of the answers on that aspect of it, but it just seems to be, I'm pretty sure it has to do with the dumbing down of America, of the dual, the double standard, do as I say, not as I do. And it's just unfortunate. I'm not even sure, even if it proves out to be that it was the Assad government, which I highly doubt, that it attacked these people. I guess it's kind of their business, but you wonder what business interests lie in there. Is it another gas and oil pipeline and they need to remove Assad? Or are there other issues that are going on there? So .com. It's the 3rd of April, 2018. El Richie arrested alleged financial chief of the cartel, Arellano Felix. Police forces in Baja California captured Ricardo Verber Campos, known as El Richie, in Tijuana. According to the data of the intelligence unit of the state police, El Richie is a financial operator in a criminal organization of the Arellano Felix brothers and is close to Luis Fernando Sanchez Arellano, the leader of the cartel, is in, until his incarceration in 2014. According to the Puerto Lindero Norte, an operation, police also detained Roxana, sister of Verber Campos, for attempting to intimidate and later bribe the agents to free El Richie, but they turned her offer down as she attempted to run down the officers, injuring the leg of one of them. She had arrived at the scene in the arrest minutes after the police action began and the Campos' arrest with her personal bodyguards. The detention was achieved on the Paseo de los Giros and the 20th of November, Colonia in Tijuana, the vehicle in which I was traveling, Chevy, Colorado, California plates, searched and inside found 40 caliber pistol with 12 rounds of ammunition and a bag of drugs inside known as crystal meth. This second one is from insightcrime.org. and it's dated the 3rd of April, 2018. Colombia arrests air traffic controllers with Sinaloa cartel links. The recent arrest in Colombia of two veteran air traffic controllers linked to Mexico's Sinaloa cartel has once again highlighted the key role played by corrupt aviation authorities in the international drug trade and the growing activity of Mexico's organized crime groups in the world's top cocaine-producing country. Working with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, Colombian authorities dismantled a network of 11 people, including corrupt officials, accused of overseeing cocaine exports for the Sinaloa cartel that departed from the Alfonso Bonilla Oregon Airport in the southwest Colombian city of Cali, reported El Tiempo. According to one of the investigators, the drugs traveled to Cali from a few hours away in the department of Cauca, and private jets delivered them to their final destination in Mexico. The group was alleged under the command of Colombian-Mexican dual citizen Jaime Hernan Velasquez, alias El Viejo, who had been arrested in 2003 for his involvement in cocaine trafficking. This is kind of another, it's slightly old, being that, what, today's the 16th, so it's close to 2 weeks, and it was an issue when it first came out about President Trump sending troops to the border. This one is from BorderlandBeat.com, the 3rd of April, 2018. Mexico asked the U.S. to clarify announcements regarding military use at the border. Foreign Minister Luis Videgaray stressed that Mexico immigration policy is exercised in a sovereign manner and according to law and not from external pressure or threats. The head of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Luis Videgaray, clarified in his social networks that the something del migrante caravan was gradually dispersed by decision of the participants and made it clear that Mexican immigration policy is not exercised from external threats. Mexican immigration policy is exercised in a sovereign manner and according to law, and not from external pressure or threats, he wrote in his Twitter account. This is how the Mexican foreign minister responded to the words of U.S. President Donald Trump, who assured that the caravan with hundreds of Central American migrants was dissolved due to the threats to cancel the North American Free Trade Agreement. In another tweet, they announced that the Mexican government requested the United States through official channels to clarify at POTUS announcement about the use of the army at the border. The government of Mexico will define a position based on this clarification and always in defense of its own sovereignty and national interest, he published in said social network. Yeah. Much to do about not much. Let's see, BorderlandBeat.com for April 2018. Court is considering granting Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo house arrest, suspected in killing DEA agent, prisoner since 1989, the 72-year-old Sinaloa capo, affected by some psychiatric psychological disorder, has filed an injunction to be granted house arrest. The second unitary criminal court in Mexico City ordered Horacio Oscar Rosetta Mentada, 8th District Judge in federal criminal proceedings in the capital of the Republic, to review the series of medical studies carried out by the Sinaloan drug trafficker Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo, alias El Padrino, the Godfather, founder of the first drug cartel in Mexico in Guadalajara, and assesses whether or not house arrest should be granted. The capo has been in prison since April of 1989 in the El Reclusio Sur de la Ciudad de Mexico of Mexico City, as well as the Confesero No. 1, El Altiplano, in Alamo, some other place in the Juarez state of Mexico, and more recently in the Federal Center for Psychological Rehabilitation in Morelos for some psychiatric psychological disorders. In his reign, he controlled drug trafficking in Mexico as well as all corridors. He remains wanted in the United States for kidnapping and the murder of DEA agent Kiki Camarena, amongst other offenses. CBP.gov/newsroom for April 2018, Dateline Tucson, Arizona. Previously deported criminal sex offender arrested. Brian A. Terry Station Border Patrol agents arrested a previously deported Mexican national late Tuesday afternoon after he re-entered the United States illegally east of Naco. Agents learned during records check that the subject, 25-year-old Jose Hernandez Martinez, was convicted in Windom, Minnesota for criminal sexual conduct in 2011 and sentenced to 1 year confinement. Hernandez will remain in federal custody, face charges for reentering the U.S. as an aggravated felon. You know, once again, this article points out that it's not just a border thing, that a lot of people have some misconception. So if it's a border thing, why is this guy was convicted in Windom, Minnesota, unless you're talking about a border on Canada? CBP.gov/newsroom, Border Patrol agents arrest convicted child molester. For April 2018, Tucson, Arizona, Tucson Station Border Patrol agents arrested a previously convicted child sex offender Tuesday evening after he re-entered the United States illegally near Sasebo. While processing Maurice Bautista Ortiz, a 31-year-old Mexican national, agents conducted a record check and learned him to be convicted in Maricopa County of child molestation in January 2013 and given life probation. Bautista will be processed for immigration violations and faces prosecution for a reentry as a felon. Let's see. The new war in Colombia's Catatumbo, and this is from InsightCrime.com, 5 April 2018. 16 months after the Colombian government and the FARC guerrilla group signed an agreement in Bogota, ending a half-century of fighting, the promise of peace is a far cry from reality, and territory still struggling with social, political, and armed conflict that have plagued them for so long. The Catatumbo region, which consists of 11 municipalities and the Department of Norte del Santander near the border of Venezuela, is one such territory. Since March 14th, disagreements between two guerrilla groups in the area, the National Liberation Army, the ELN, and the Popular Liberation Army, the EPL, have resulted in an ongoing armed confrontation unprecedented in either group's history, and it has local communities on high alert. United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has been documenting the impact of this confrontation on the civilian population. In a press release published on March 16th, OCHA reported clashes between the ELN and the EPL affecting people living in the municipalities of this place, that place, that place, that place. People living in the area were affected by massive displacement, mobility restriction, and the closure of businesses and schools, which affected 11,836 students and 553 teachers. Two civilians were injured, and a number of both the civilians and the UN medical personnel were temporarily kidnapped. All of this constitutes violation of international human law. In a second press release, the OCAH reported on March 20 that in San Calixico, rural settlements, this place and that place, and then the village of some other place, approximately 1,350 people were gathered in humanitarian shelters to escape the crossfire. See, we're down at the bottom of the hour. Music will be coming in here, and then we'll get back to our study of about guerrilla warfare and the inception and the evolution of an insurgency. and laying the groundwork, as I know that there's some people here that have not been exposed to what we're talking about when we use terms, guerrilla warfare, insurgency, things like that, so just as to keep people up to date. So main thing is we want to join together with the band. We really need to stop all this infighting between networks and talk show hosts and different groups and cast aside our indifferences, and we can either hang together or we can hang separately. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today's date is the 16th of April, 2018. It's a Monday. We'll get back to our study of insurgency and talk about the inception and the evolution of an insurgency. The first 30 minutes, we covered some topics, my email address, Bob Miner's contact information, observations about the passings of a couple of people. I made some comparisons of about the United States government's response to certain things around the world and what's going on now with Syria and how everything doesn't quite seem to line up. And then we also covered some border news issues. Of course, you're not going to hear these things on the mainstream media because they're too busy helping promote somebody on some book tour, and a lot of distraction of what's going on. So about the inception and the evolution of an insurgency, because the transition to the Civil War and some alternate solutions. So one of the things that an insurgency in its incipient, in phase one of the insurgency, you have the leadership, the cadre of the insurgent group that get together and start putting together a group of, you know, the different parts of it, the political arm, the military arm, the decide if it's going to be an inclusive or an exclusive organization. The main thing is what they're going to try to do is get a cause, something that resonates with the people to motivate them to join with the band. And so they have a cause. So just for the sake of it, let's just say that a cause exists and the peaceful alternatives have been exhausted and the revolutionary organizations have come into being, or perhaps only in a skeletal form, but sufficient to the immediate need. Now, somewhere in the remote province, which will be the most revolutionary because the most neglected and the most favorable to the guerrilla actions, and that's because of the most primitive and inaccessible, and so the insurrection breaks and it starts to spread. And the rebel band springs into existence, composed of armed civilians who call themselves patriots and whom the government will call bandits or militia or communists. And a government arsenal is assaulted. A police post is burned. A radio station is briefly seized. And a proclamation is issued in the name of the revolution. The hour is at hand. The people are in arms. The tyrant or puppet or foreigner must go. A blow has been struck for the national liberation, and the lines of battle are drawn. The aims and the principles of the revolution are specified in appropriate rhetoric with patriotic references and historical footnotes, and they are just aims, worthy principles. But who would propound any other? They involve the popular grievances, and they strike a popular response. The towns and the countryside are abuzz with rumors. Young men and boys who have longed for the day of decision hasten to consult one another as to the role that each can or should or will play in the conflict to come. Members of the opposition parties who have always been confined to their intransigencies in the lecture platforms and the writings of editorials, now must take a position. The blow that's been struck is a catalyst, deciding new alignments and future attitudes. Who's going to join the rebels? Who will walk the neutral line or abandons his principles and makes a common cause with the oppressor? Since it's not in the nature of governments to treat with the armed civilians, the insurrection must be put down, order reestablished, and confidence restored. Although there are discreet questions being put by foreign embassies, and although these embassies want reassurances, they're not above consulting with the political opposition. They may even establish an informal liaison with the rebels, both to gain intelligence and by way of insurance. Business leaders and banks, both foreign and domestic, will be close behind and not always so discreet. the situation, if allowed to develop, is certain to attract foreign journalists and the rebels, perhaps insignificant in themselves from the government's point of view, will then find a platform from which to amplify their cause and the embarrassment of the region a 10,000-fold. The government's not concerned about the loss of a few policemen or even an arsenal, but it is terrified of the attendant publicity, which casts doubts on its stability and thus on the future of the economy. Besides, who knows what other insurrections may not be brewing. Reassuring statements are issued, provincial garrisons are quietly reinforced, an expedition is sent, with as little fanfare as possible, to expatriate the bandits root and branch. Now is the critical time for the revolution. If the insurrection has been well-timed, the terrain well-chosen, and the guerrilla leaders competent and determined, the military effort will fail. The experience of scores of guerrilla campaigns in the era since World War II, indeed of the American Revolution and the Peninsular War in Spain from 1804 to 1914, shows that it is virtually impossible to stamp out guerrillas in rural areas where they have room to maneuver and to hide, assuming that they also have the support of the rural population. How conceivably it may be accomplished by exterminating the rural population itself, but those draconian methods failed even the Nazis in Eastern Europe, and not for the scruples or lack of determination on their part. Now, this is not to say that the guerrillas can win battles. Now, in the early stage of the insurgency, they will have no business to seek battles and every reason to shun them. Rather, the rebel strategy will be, one, to attack only when assured of success by the overwhelming superiority of firepower, the position, and the element of surprise, and only in pursuit of limited objectives such as capture of arms, or to create a diversion from some other action, or to avoid encirclement. And number two, to use the campaign as an education tool and as a propaganda weapon by disclosing the impotence of the enemy and showing that he can be defied with impunity, to proselytize amongst the rural population by identifying with its grievances and aspirations and by putting the burden and the blame of bloodshed on the repressive government as the clear aggressor. And it'll be necessary to become in the course of the anti-guerrilla campaign. Now, in the beginning, only small actions in isolated sectors will be possible, and later, as the guerrilla grows stronger, they're going to divide their forces to take their revolutionary message into new areas and to harass the army on a broader scale, forcing it to extend its lines so that its defenses are weakened and small units can be reduced one at a time. And throughout the campaign to the final stage, the rebel strategy will be to avoid a military decision until an equalization of forces has been reached and the government army can be confronted on the battlefield with clear assurance of success. Now, at the onset, the defiance will be enough. The existence of insurgency will in itself serve to discredit the government and so to advance the rebel cause. Now, the difficulty will be in to continue to make political capital of an uprising that can exist, an initial of only small actions. Now, just as the regime depends for its life on the appearance of stability and progress, so does the rebel leader depend on action as a means of asserting his intransigencies and winning the mass support. Once again, both the government and the insurgents are competing for that big slice of pie in the middle, the strategic terrain, which is the people and the population. So the guerrillas have struck their opening blow. the moment Hot Pursuit dies, they must turn and strike again at the vanguard of the expeditionary force or its outpost and a supply column and a depot where arms can be obtained. Now, if their clandestine organization in the towns is up to it, there will now be incidents of terrorism or of industrial sabotage to heighten the crisis. And if there are atrocities in the way of the reprisal on the part of the authorities, they must be well publicized. If there are martyrs, they must be big funerals, protests led by the mothers of the slain, outcries of popular indignation. Now, ideally, there will be general strikes, and with it will come further repression, a curfew, beatings, arrests, creating further alienation of the populace from the regime, perhaps creating new martyrs and new incidents. Now, as it becomes clear that the government can no longer maintain order and cannot suppress the insurrection, the revolutionary tide begins to rise and swell. Students join the ranks of the underground, the working class and the liberal middle class elements of the towns, the housewives, the white-collar workers, the out-political faction, the economic nationalist, idealist of one sort or another, and the disaffected of all classes join the popular protest against persecution and the loss of civil liberties. Hunted members of the clandestine organization, they flee to the countryside to join the guerrillas and the peasants who have become the victims of the military campaign, which is sure to claim innocent casualties or who have fallen under suspicion for their association with the rebels, also swell the insurgent force. And as it grows, it becomes capable of action over a wider territory. But even more important, it becomes capable of establishing guerrilla bases in areas which the military can no longer control. With the establishment of such bases comes into being a rebel government and a guerrilla economy, capable of supporting the guerrilla fighters independent of raids and smuggled supplies from the towns. And then in the later phase, the base areas are expanded, continual pressure being maintained against the government forces on their perimeter until the guerrillas hold or operate freely in most of the rural territory of entire regions, confining the army, except for excursions, which will grow shorter and more dangerous as time passes, to their fortified strong points in the towns. So at this point, the conflict begins to resemble a civil war between territorial entities of the same nation and each of its separate economy and government. And there will, however, be significant differences. One, the territory of the guerrillas will be rural and its economy agricultural and primitive, while the economy of the enemy will be industrial, continuing to present targets for the sabotage and his territory increasingly restricted to the urban areas. And number two, the legitimate government will continue to suffer all the pangs and pressures, the political, diplomatic, economic, of a regime confronted by open insurgency, which it cannot suppress, while the rebels will only gain prestige and popular support by their successful insurgency. Now, we've been discussing characteristic developments in a revolutionary situation, from the start of an insurgency to the point at which a relative balance of forces is reached. So the question remains as to what sort of decision will follow, military or political. Now, in the smaller semi-colonial countries with economies and to some extent government dependent on richer and more powerful neighbors, Cuba is a revolutionary prototype, you can be inclined to believe that the political decision, the easier and less costly of the alternatives, is almost always possible, barring outside intervention. The Cuban revolutionary provides an excellent example of the process that we've been discussing in a hypothesis. the stage has been set. On December of 1956, Fidel Castro and 81 armed followers disembarked from a leaking motor cruiser on the lonely shore of Cuban's easternmost province of Oriental, arriving from Mexico. And in the months that followed, the force was reduced to a round dozen, most of the other men being killed or captured in military ambushes because before they could make their way into the mountains. And Castro's military activities during the next 6 months were minuscule. They consisted of small raids on isolated army posts. Yet the first produced sufficient captured weapons to double the force when recruits were found, the sugar mills and the villages on the edge of the Sierra Maestra range. Now, when Castro was first met in the Sierra in April of 57, he had perhaps 100 followers. Half of those had arrived only 2 weeks before from Santiago, the provincial capital, where they had formed the bulk of the urban underground. Now, the single biggest action of the Fidelistas during that period was an attack on the 28th of May, 1957, on the small military outpost of Ubero, manned by about 70 soldiers. And the rebel losses came to 8 dead, and the military losses were put at 30. Now, other actions during the first year were on a similar scale or smaller, and at no time during the entire insurrection period did battles involve more than a few hundred men on either side. And in almost all cases of unprovoked attack, where there was no prior move by the Batista government, the rebel purpose was to capture weapons with which to arm more guerrillas. And the scale of action was miniature, yet propaganda victories came early and were international in their scope. One followed the other. The reports of New York Times correspondent Herbert Matthews made Fidel Castro's name a household word in the United States, and subsequent publicity carried it around the world. So in effect, on the political and economic level, it was to bring about an American arms embargo against the government of Batista to discourage investment and restrict the credits to such an extent as to put a severe strain on the regime and to cause gradually a failure of nerve within the administration that spread to the military and made it practically impotent long before most of the troops had ever heard a rifle shot. So the Batista regime was hopelessly corrupt and inefficient, and when it fell, it appeared superficially to have fallen of its own weight and weakness. And the foreign journalists covering the story could not quite believe that Castro's handful of bearded riflemen had had much to do with it except on the propaganda level. So at first, Batista had been disdainful of what appeared to be a small band of political adventurers, most completely isolated in the remote Sierra Maestra. Now, after the first fitful attempts to flush the guerrillas out of the mountain, he was inclined to dismiss the danger and to cede to Castro by default a territory so remote, inaccessible, thinly populated, and uneconomic as to be scarcely worth bothering about. The bandits had existed in the Sierra long before and had attracted little attention and had did no great harm. Doubtlessly, Batista reasoned that publicity would soon die away and that in due time the adventurers would be starved out of their sanctuary or grow weary on a fruitless campaign and give up. Later, he was to feel that he had grossly underestimated the threat and to see rebels everywhere, even where there were none. And with a secure mountain base, Castro was able to recruit a strong irregular force and to make what it had seemed many times stronger than it actually was. The fast-moving guerrilla patrols, sometimes of only a half a dozen men, managed to be everywhere at once. No army patrol was quite safe in the mountains. No outpost, sugar plantation, or village was safe in the foothills or within striking distance of them. And when Castro grandiosely announced, quote, total war, in March of 1958 and warned of columns moving quickly north, east, and west towards key objectives in all parts of the island, the Army reacted as to an invasion. It had no way of knowing that the columns consisted of fewer than 200 men in all, or that a so-called second front announced at the same time had been opened in northern Oriental by a force of no more than 65 guerrillas, their heaviest weapon a 30 caliber Browning automatic rifle. So at the onset of the insurrection, Batista had sent 5,000 soldiers to the Sierra Maestra to cordon off the area and eliminate the guerrillas. The Sierras run more than 100 miles east and west and is 15 to 25 miles deep. So simple arithmetic shows how impossible was the task set for the Army, given a trackless terrain of precipitous and thickly wooded mountains. It would have been impossible with twice as many troops. Aircraft were used against the guerrillas, but as Castro noted, the thick, wet woods blotted out the effects of the high explosive bombs and the napalm within 25 to 50 yards. And there was little danger, even had the bombardiers been accurate and the locations of the guerrillas known, and neither of these ifs ever prevailed. The only damage done by the aircraft was to the thatch bolsillos of the mountain dwellers living in the cultivated clearing, and the Sierra quickly became the first territorio libre of the revolution, and the first year was devoted by the free-ranging guerrillas to building a rear base economy, small shops for the fabrication of uniforms and equipment, for making crude explosive devices, and for repairing arms, or for canning foodstuffs, and so on, and proselytizing the inhabitants of the zone. The harassment of the outlying districts and the inception or the interception of the army patrols were undertaken as a matter of course, and it was relatively easy because of the superior military intelligence of the guerrillas, thanks to the cooperation of the population, and seldom was the military patrol able to come within even a few miles of the Fidelistas' force without the guerrillas becoming aware of it. Now, one of Castro's first acts on entering the Sierra had been to execute two bandits accused of rape and murder, and so dramatically establishing a revolutionary government with a code of law, which would be looked to as a stabilizing in the force in an area long neglected by the Havana government. So the next step, important in winning the following political and recruiting militarily, was to promulgate an agrarian reform law that conferred title on hundreds of small tenants, sharecroppers, and squatters who were told that they now owned the land that they tilled. And similar tactics were followed in the more densely populated rich coffee-growing uplands of the so-called Segundo Frente, the Frank Paris, opened by Raul Castro. A code of law was imposed, taxes were collected, and certain benefits, schools and hospitals, were conferred in return. The supplies were scrupulously paid for in cash. The villagers were treated much as they would have been treated by any ordinary government, except that the political indoctrination was more intense and more was demanded of them in the way of identification with the revolution and adherence to its goals. the few rural guard posts in the area were quickly eliminated, and since they consisted of no more than a few men at each post, they presented no obstacle for even so small an army as that of Raul Castro with 65 men, all of whom could be concentrated on a single objective at a time. The army columns sent into the area were ambushed as they entered and then, after brief resistance, allowed to pass. And as they returned, they were likely to be ambushed again at another point and again permitted to pass. Now, if pursued, the guerrillas simply withdrew into the wooded hills, dispersed, and regrouped elsewhere. And when the zone was clear, they returned to the villages. And after a few weeks of the futile exercise, the army ceased to send patrols and contented itself with strengthening the garrisons in the towns on the outskirts of the free territory. But as the rebel force grew from the internal recruitment and its economy prospered, these garrisons too became unsafe and had to be reduced in number for reasons of security. Now, in terms both of expense and of military manpower, it became simply uneconomical for the government to attempt to hold dozens of tiny villages and farms and to police an area several thousand square miles in extent, and so the military excursions ceased and the villages were abandoned to the rebels. The military having no larger towns and an easy provincial capital to defend. Now, in that manner, the liberated territory was gradually extended, and at its expanding periphery, a no-man's land was created, visited by both rebel and Batista troops, but held by neither, and slowly bits of the neutral strip were also nibbled away as not worth fighting for, and the free zone continued to grow. I see we're up at the end of today's broadcast. I'd like to say thanks for tuning into Liberty Tree Radio, and your mind is your primary weapon. And what I'm trying to stress here is once we start to understand the parts and pieces of what an insurgency is, and that's just the first step, and then we start to study the different insurgent movements that has especially happened since World War II to get a better grasp on what actually happened and what worked. Now, I'll see you back next week here on Liberty Tree Radio, and I hope that you have a wonderful day. Thanks for being with us.
Any minute now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked inside, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.